Okay, this is talking to Michael Larch over the telephone from Radio Physics to the University of Sydney on 16 March 78. Now, can you tell me when you first came in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I was at Cambridge University. I went up to the undergraduate course in 1915.
I see.
And of course, radio astronomy was been going for a while. And I was very familiar with what was it, the Grange Road instrument that Martin Ryle's installed.
Even as an undergraduate?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, we used to walk round the university grounds and round the surrounding countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew about these aerials, and we talked about them, and we only partly understood what was going on. In fact, I'd lived in Cambridge before then, for a year or two, and we knew about these incidents in 1948.
I see.
We knew something was going on, we didn't know very much about it.
Right.
And my first introduction, I suppose, when I started to understand the scientific side, was during my undergraduate courses, when we had lectures from Martin Ryle and from Ratcliffe.
I see.
And we had questions in our physics papers on radio astronomy, and we began to see that it was a scientific subject.
Right.
Because before then, I suppose, you know, we got the, from the general popular point of view, radio astronomy was only just getting going, and
taken
very seriously by the astronomers.
Right. Now, when you say we, you're talking about
I'm just talking about I suppose I'm thinking now at school more than anything. We knew a bit about astronomy. We were very inspired by Fred Hoyle in those days, when he was. He gave I'm going back a bit now, of course.
To the early 50s,
He gave a series of lectures on the BBC Third Programme.
Oh, yes.
Which you may recall was that very Hoppy Nose programme, which was inspired by all except very intellectual.
Yes.
And we used to solemnly listen to Fred Hoyle's lectures on the nature of the universe.
This was the early 50s?
This was probably before 50, probably 48, 49, I think.
So this was, even before you entered Cambridge
University.
Yes.
And he dramatized modern astronomy at that time and brought it before the public in a way I think hadn't been done before.
I see.
And with his very broad Yorkshire accent, you know, his sweeping generalization and so on, he really captured a lot of people's imagination.
So
and
the
combination of that and seeing these radio astronomy instruments going up became this. Certainly,
made a strong impression.
Yeah. And then I went up to the university to read physics, which I'd been interested in anyway, and not particularly astronomy. And gradually learned what radio astronomy was all about. Then I got my degree in Cambridge and stayed on to do meteorological physics and the wormhole, atmospheric electricity.
Right.
And of course, we knew we were in the whole underfall hut built by TCR, the cross Medingley Road from the observatory.
Yes.
So we had some sort of, ours was a very small and isolated little group, we had some contact with Ratcliffe's group, the atmospheric group, and Martin Ryle, and also the observatory.
But what made you decide to go to Jarrell Bank then?
Well, what happened there was that I didn't get back to apply to, I did quite well in my university career, obviously, and looking around for a university. And I applied to go to Keele, which was a new university.
Right.
In England at the time, the great part of Oxford and Cambridge. But I didn't get that job because the other applicant, the other applicant didn't want to.
Are you getting further?
To Manchester because his father's professor there. And the job at Jodrell turned up by accident.
I see.
I went back to see Ratcliffe and said, "Look, I'm sorry I didn't get this job." And he said, "Oh well, don't worry. I strongly advise you to apply to Manchester." And then behind the scenes, I think they got the job there for me.
I see.
I think that's the way that happened. But all that exactly concerned in that while I was in Cambridge, of course, the great thing was the one of the sporting things was the annual sports. Thing between the various physics groups. And Martin Ryle was the anchor man in the tug of war team.
I see.
you may have heard that from.
No, I haven't actually.
He was a big man at the end of the rowboat. He said,
"Yes."
They always won the tug of war in this. Pulled against Martin Ryle a couple of times.
Right.
So I got to Jodrell, and of course there was an atmosphere of tremendous excitement there. The time I went there,
this was what year now? 57?
57.
And the dish was in what state at that time?
I'm not sure whether it was the end of 56 or beginning of 57.
Well, that's all right. That's
close enough. Anyway, you can find out from the record if you really want.
Right.
I just can't remember what it is. Anyhow, it was the time when the bishops were still in scaffolding.
Right.
And it really stood out above the Cheshire countryside in a way which was very dramatic.
Right.
And my first impression of driving around those little lanes and you see this great thing and then it would disappear behind the trees and then suddenly
right.
You
know, it's still that way, actually.
You felt very excited by the whole atmosphere of the Great
Right.
I remember thinking how strange it was that things were small in this big parabolic mirror. How did they know it was working?
Yes.
I had to go through the radar sign of things.
Yes.
And the local people didn't know very much what it was at all. They knew there was this thing doing it. Now, what happened then, you probably know this side of the story. There was the thing was going very slowly.
Well, of course, Lovell is written.
Not Shuttle Bank, and they decided to speed things up by removing the scaffolding from the telescope. Have you heard this?
Why would this speed things up?
Hmm?
Why would this speed things up? What do you mean?
I don't know. It enabled them to get on and finish some other parts of it.
I see.
And what they did was they removed the scaffolding before the membrane was complete. And
yes.
Before the welded steel plates were complete.
Right.
And the result of that was that the thing distorted and was never a very good figure after that.
Hmm.
But it was probably the right decision to do, nonetheless, because shortly after they'd got it moving, the Sputnik went up.
Right.
And of course, Dobrell really hit the world headlines then with the Sputnik work.
Right.
And several very dramatic days and episodes in all of in that time. Well, first of all, the first Sputnik itself, we actually detected that at Dobrell. I suppose as most people did with an aerial on the ground.
Right. It was. I heard the story.
With a big telescope.
Yes.
But in fact, the all the news media was there and the lights and
that right.
Was a real emotional highlight. I suppose really the excitement. I remember when the satellite first went up, coming in. I think it was Friday or something?
It was
near a weekend anyhow.
That's right, it was a Friday.
Was there. And I said, right. Well, they must do something about this jolly satellite. They said, oh, we'll wait till Monday. I don't think he realised quite what was going to hit him.
Hmm.
As with the news media, you know, when they cottoned on to the fact that the bank might do something.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there was the proof that the thing was there at all by radar. I didn't have much to do with that, but there was a lot of disbelief that the satellite was there at all.
There was a hoax of some kind?
But it was some sort of hoax, and Dobrell proved that quite conclusively.
Yeah.
And then the same thing later on when, what's it called? The lunar something or other.
Lunic or something like that?
One of the lunics in the moon.
Yes.
And Professor David, he's now in the JD lady.
Right.
Hacked the doctor ship of that satellite of itself, that rocket of itself in the moon. And proved conclusively, you know, there was no other explanation that they had in fact fallen through the landing on the surface.
Because it was accelerating so fast.
If the acceleration was exactly like it just couldn't have been. There was a lot of disbelief, but I think Dobrell played an important part in those early days.
Now, what were you specifically involved in yourself?
Well, I went there to work on one of the programs which had been designed in the early days, before the hydrogen line was discovered. It was intended to use Dobrell Bank as a meter wave telescope only.
Right.
There was no idea of going as low as 21 centimeters.
Right.
And by the time the thing was actually going, I think the 480 megahertz survey work had rather seemed less important because of all the emphasis on the hydrogen line. And they gave me the task anyway of getting the 400 side of things going.
I see.
And I spent, I must have been 18 months pottering around in the laboratory trying to improve receivers and getting a Dickey switch type of system going and so on. And not being very experienced in radio astronomy at the time, it took me a while.
Right, so it was a training period.
The field. Then Don Matheson came.
Right.
And joined me, and also Lynn Hazard was a research student. I think Don came first and, I can't remember. But they both came about the same time after I'd been there about 18 months. And that really got our little group going. And we got a decent receiver and got on the air and started those observations of the paper you referred to. That
right. What were the particular difficulties that you had in...
Oh, well, the difficulty, One of the difficulties was getting time on the telescope. There was always a tremendous rush to change over and do something else, so we'd be very frustrated by the time. We had terrible troubles with the cable. You know, bad contact in the character of the cable, basically being through that one.
The receivers
were always difficult, and we were struggling to figure the noise ratio.
And you had that strange in today's light, mast arrangement for the focus, right?
We realized after a while the only way we were going to get any sort of sensitive result from 408 was to get the receiver up the mast.
Right.
And this was a great struggle because there was no lift. We had to climb up this ladder. It was quite frightening. It's 60 feet up above the vertex.
Right.
And we hauled up this great steel box. I can remember it now. It must have weighed a lot of tons, but it seemed very heavy. We could just about carry it. I think if you look at that report that Don Matheson wrote.
Yes, right. I have a copy of that. Yes.
Some of those pictures of lugging this, I think there's one of a rope hauling this box up the tower.
Yes, there is, right.
That was a terrible struggle. Look, we took the whole thing very much for personal talent. We're terribly deeply involved in it. We think about it, dream about it, and we work together as a group. That's myself, Don Matheson, and Richard. And we were very loyal to one another, and we were almost a little clique separate from them. Goddard was like that. It had these buildings scattered around the field.
I see.
And there was the cosmic ray, the cosmic group, the hydrogen ion group, the meteor group, and so on. And because they lived in their little huts and didn't meet very much, it became very cliquey.
I see.
And certainly, Don Matheson, I think Lynn felt it particularly. With a very isolated little determined protective group. And the whole thing was very much in front of you. Getting the receivers going, getting the stuff up.
Right. Were there no staff meetings between these different groups?
There wasn't very much. There were sort of progress meetings from time to time when you got up and said what we were doing.
But
had the ground call a very key part in the whole of it.
How was that?
Because Hanford Brown was the person to whom everybody referred, particularly, because I was a relatively junior assistant lecturer, relatively junior. And people like myself and the research students, and Henry Brown was a sort of father figure to us.
Mm-hmm.
We were, all the real contact and scientific coordination and so on came through Henry Brown by informal contact.
I see.
Because he was always very kind, and he always talked to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because of the enormous example that he set. I mean, his work was so superb and so admirable.
Right.
That I think everyone there with any sort of interest in science had a tremendous admiration for him. I mean, I'm sure far more than he realized.
Yes. And then, what was Lovell's role then?
Well, I mean, he was the entrepreneur. I mean, I hope I'm not saying I don't want to be. You mustn't quote me in such a way. That
well, any quotes I want to make, I will ask your.
I mean, I'm being quite frank with you, and I'm
right. Well, any quotes I want to make, I will ask your permission.
Professor Lovell, of course, was the entrepreneur who got the whole thing going.
Right.
Enormously enthusiastic, and he was interested in the scientific programs in a general what scientific impact is it going to have type of attitude.
Mm-hmm.
But Hanford Brown was the one who would sit down and work out the scientific consequences and would design features and would discuss seriously in terms of the known literature and so on.
Right.
What it was sensible to do and what it wasn't sensible to do. Lovell was more interested in the it's unkind to say this, it's probably not entirely fair, but in the dramatic side.
Yes, well, I don't think that. Well, I don't think that's any secret, really.
No, it's no secret.
Right. But
it was, from my point of view, and I'm sure from a lot of them, Andrew Brown is the man who kept the whole thing together.
Well, that's a very interesting comment. And then, of course, he left in when 60.
He left just before I did. In fact, he must have left in 1962.
And do you think that Jodrell Bank suffered for that?
I left. Certainly changed.
Yes.
I mean, that was my first job at Jodrell, and I suppose I got to think that all the working world was exciting like this.
Yes.
We were in the limelight one way or another the whole time, and that we responded to it by accepting it as a personal challenge. And, you know, all our work was done with enormous sincerity and dedication.
Well,
a sort of thing which doesn't occur very much, generally speaking, in the outside world of the world. It doesn't occur in the same as it here.
Yeah.
There's no question now, as we expect, that they were unusual years.
Mm-hmm. What about the overall scientific direction of the Institute, for instance, basic decisions on telescope scheduling and so forth? Who made those decisions?
As far as the scientific program was concerned, I'm sure it was mainly Henry Brill. Rosie Davies later took over a lot of it. J.G. Davies was more concerned with technical matters, really.
Yeah.
He wasn't very much concerned with the radio astronomy program. He was very good on technical stuff.
So it's not really fair, then, to say that Lovell ran it in a very autocratic manner.
What was terribly frustrating was the way the scheduling would be popped around. It was terribly difficult to get time. In fact, there was one program that Matthews and I were running, and we were very anxious to complete it, as one always is, and it was the usual thing at Dodd, and we were struggling for telescope time, and we were battling for another day. And we had a terrible struggle to get this one more day to finish the observing.
But was this just because there were too many people and only one telescope?
It was very bad, and we felt, the scientific staff, the astronomy staff, felt it was very badly scheduled, because...
In what sense do you mean?
Because it would be popped over so rapidly and such short notice for other purposes. Now, very often we didn't know why, it just seemed arbitrary, the thing we take in our heads.
Yeah, but you mean there wasn't a schedule set up for 3 months that you could rely on? There was not a schedule set up for the next 3 months that you could rely on.
Oh, I don't like the way it's happened at all, then. I don't have to, you put in your request at the time, and you get it at rather short notice.
Oh, I see.
You wouldn't know what you were getting.
Oh, I see. And you might get booted off before you expected to.
It was dominated by the satellite program.
Oh, yes.
By attacking the Pioneer things a bit later on, and before that, by attacking rockets.
As
a result, that it would be swapped over just to keep the excitement up.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that the space program and the PR aspects got in the way of the science. So.
There's no question that they did.
Yes.
And we came to resent, I'm afraid. I mean, I see we were young and brash. Because we dedicated ourselves so much to our program, we thought they were dominating importance for all this stuff.
Yeah.
And we thought a lot of the PR stuff and the rocket tracking and so on was foolish. We resented in particular the NASA people.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were a bit later. They came and put transmitters on the telescope.
Right.
Oh, then there was the transmitters, of course. We have this basic problem that the transmission experiments going on at Dodd, meteor program. And, of course, transmitters on the radio astronomy site don't help.
Right, exactly.
And somebody has probably told you about the compression system we have.
No, go ahead.
We typed around the whole station, encoded pulses, with which you had to turn off your receiver during these pulses so the transmitters could transmit.
I see.
And this was a standard feature of all the early receivers of Dodd. They had the suppression circuit in them.
Huh.
Which I can't remember the pattern there. I think it was a double pulse every 50 milliseconds or something.
That's interesting.
It just switched the finger them.
And this was on for the entire time you were there, the system?
Yes, I think it was. I mean, the meteor program was closed down about 1962 or 63. All that time, the meteor transmitters were going pretty continuously.
But also the NASA transmitters,
too. The NASA transmitter came in later. That was there in 1957. That must have been about 1960. And I suppose part of our resentment, not everybody would say there was this resentment, by the way, part of our resentment of them was that, of course, they were very well paid, they lived like kings, and they had an immediate access to the telescope, which we didn't have.
Yes.
They had to put in the personal commitment that we had of building equipment and struggling with the thing.
Right. Oh, it's very natural, sure.
And also they were Americans. People are a little resentful in the United States.
Sure. They probably had much better equipment, too.
Oh, of course they did, yes.
And everything in double quantities.
Yeah, I mean, they were friendly to us in a condescending sort of way.
No, I know what you mean. It's a common situation when someone moves in, essentially. Let's talk about the scientific results that you got from these early 408 megahertz results. For instance, the Cygnus X and the Cygnus Loop observations.
Well, I think the most interesting ones were probably the first one was the Andromeda Nebula.
Okay.
That, of course, we did, obviously, the case of Henry Brown.
Right.
Trying to check up on the corona that he found with the early 710 foot thick gravel at that, something megahertz. He found that some M31 had a very large radio corona.
Right.
And in those days, all galaxies were supposed to have radio corona as well as ours.
Right.
And so it was a natural thing, and Henry was very keen on this, and I did it. To look at M31 and 408, see what the corona was doing.
Well, what did you find?
Well, if you look at the publication, you'll find that it wasn't anywhere near as clear as Hans's original corona. I think there was stuck to it.
You had
it wasn't as big and as clear as I think you expected.
You had these spurs coming out of the disk.
We had little spurs coming out the side, and we were locked. Our resolution wasn't good enough to tell what was going on. And we attempted to fit a corona to it, and argue the thing away by saying the spectrum must be rather steep and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the consensus of opinion now is that, I mean, our observations were right. Our interpretation was probably biased by the fact that we really believed there was a corona there.
And,
yeah,
once again.
Now, I think if you look back at it, you probably realize the big attempt to fuse by Mr. Michael's our own galaxy factor.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real evidence from our 408 thing of any coronas doing that.
And you also looked at the coma cluster.
The coma cluster, well, you know, we just looked at anything we thought was good ideas.
Right, right.
There again, what we were really looking for was to see if there was any background emission from the cluster as a whole, as distinct from the individual galaxies.
Right.
And we could kind of come to no conclusion on that. I mean, looking at it with hindsight, clearly we didn't
really like
it.
Right. What about the Cygnus X and Cygnus Loop observations? What were the main results from them?
That's something I think it's the Cygnus X thing. The Cygnus X is a big thermal region.
Right.
And we showed quite a careful analysis of that, that part of it was non-thermal. And that has since been mitigated. So that the main thing we got out of that, a very sensitive, of course we had huge signal of noise there, a sensitive map of the region, that resolution, and what has subsequently been shown, that the exit region we thought was non-thermal was in fact, so we found a non-thermal source of it.
Yeah, yeah. And the Cygnus Loop observations?
Cygnus Loop, this was really Don Mathis and Cetus that worked. He went to town analyzing that, trying to sort out the non-thermal thermal part of it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, that stood for a long time. We thought we had evidence that there was some sort of emission leaking out of the bottom. You know, the supernova has broken at the bottom, and a lot of material had been shot out through it somehow. I don't know about the interpretation. The map was right. People have surveyed it since and come up with everything from there.
Right. What about the...
I think, looking back, you know, we were a bit weak on the astronomy. We were so keen on the technical side and on the... which we did very well, though that work we did was very accurate. I mean, we made no mistakes in it.
Yes.
Our content was very good, but I think we were weak on the astronomical interpretation.
Yeah, and in terms of...
You know, there was such pressure to... we really believed that because we'd observed it with this marvelous new instrument and everything was so dramatic, all we had to do was observe it carefully.
Because you had the best telescope.
Our role, and then we brushed on as we weren't experienced.
Right.
This is very much what we did.
And what about the research students? Were they getting any training in astronomy at Jodl at that time?
Oh, they were. I'm not too fair here. It wouldn't be fair to say. I mean, they were thrown into the whole thing, and they did what was necessary. They were expected to make apparatus and behave as a slave for a while. Some of them took an inordinate time to get their PhDs.